Welcome to the Rise Network podcast show, a podcast dedicated to help you reach your dream lifestyle through investing in real estate. We're going to be sitting down with new, intermediate, and experienced investors to talk all about real estate and how it has changed their lives. If you're looking to scale your portfolio or even just get into real estate investing, you're in the right place. Make sure to tune in.
What's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Rise Real Estate Investing Podcast with your host, Mayu Taba and
Austin Yeh. Mayu, you're rocking another OVO t-shirt. Like, okay, guys, let's make a contest. Let's go on Mayu's Instagram and then like just take a shot for every single time he's wearing an OVO shirt. This time he's wearing
an OVO. On my Instagram, I do not wear OVO.
You don't?
No.
On your stories, you do. On your stories. Yeah, you probably wear a dress shirt. That's OVO.
Dude, dress shirt or a polo.
But
awesome, man. What have you been up to?
What have I been up to? So I think people like to hear about tenant situations specifically because I feel like everyone goes through it at one point or another. So I have a couple updates. One of them is basically a tenant who paid half the rent for a couple of months. Not the entire rent, just half the rent for a couple of months. And then we got her to sign an N-11, basically giving her a timeline to catch up. We filed an N-4 and an N-11, telling her to catch up. Wasn't able to do it. And then I filed the L-3 to go with the N-11. In 2 weeks, I got
a sheriff's... But you filed an N-4 and an N-11?
An N-4 for the non-payment of rent.
Okay.
And then an N-11 as well, because she agreed that she'll move out if she doesn't pay the rent by a specific date.
Interesting.
So I use it as leverage, right? I like, because...
I mean, you could have enforced the N-11 regardless if she paid though, no?
I could have, yes, but I wouldn't have. Like, market rents.
Ah, okay.
Market rents. So I gave her my word. So I was intending to keep to the word, and she wasn't able to keep to her. So yeah, I mean, filed it. And in 2 weeks, I got the sheriff's eviction notice. And now she's moving everything out. And I'm going to go through with the N-4 as well. So, because I know where she's moving to next. I think one of her daughters owns a farm and that she's going to move in with her. And I have a way to collect the rents now, the missing rents on top of that. Because I know
where out that her daughter owns her farm, and how do you even know where that farm is?
She's transparent. She's told us. She's like, we're like, oh, where are you going to move to? She's like, here. My daughter owns this, that, whatever. So that's going to be the situation. So I'm like, okay, you still owe me a couple $1,000. So we're intended to come after it. But she's not employed, which makes it pretty difficult.
Yeah. There's nothing to garnish. Yeah.
And I don't think she has assets. So there's nothing to seize as well.
Yeah. Interesting. I've got a little non-payment of rent up in Sudbury going on right now. Tenant is $1,000 a month and fell behind by 1 month. To be honest, I don't even know if I should say this on the podcast. Like, I'm okay letting it get a little bit bigger to guarantee they get out. If that makes
sense. You can use it as a negotiation leverage. Once it gets
It needs to get a little bit more painful.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense, right? If you're going to cash for keys, I mean, you would have paid the guy 10 G's, let it get to 7 G's and be like, yo, get out.
Yeah. I don't know if I can get in trouble for saying this on the thing. Next thing you know, I end up at the LTV court case and they pull up this recording.
Pull this?
Like, this motherfucker's intentional. But other than that, been looking at some commercial deals. Nothing that we can kind of publicly talk about just yet, but you know, there's some cool stuff, a couple clients and stuff like that on the commercial side, kind of piquing my interest as well there. Investing wise, there is, are you looking at flips or no?
I do look at flips from time to time, yes, but I'm a little bit worried in taking action on one right now.
Yeah, some people are making good money on flips right now.
I know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen some of our wholesale deals where people are making really good money, and I was like, maybe I should have flipped that, right? But
I don't know what it is, though, because I'd be concerned about like the liquidity side of it, but people seem to be selling. I mean, obviously, right now, the supply side is pretty increasing, but not that great. So maybe that's helping.
I guess it's still a lack of really good inventory. And it was the same issue last year. There was a lack of really good turnkey inventory. And buyers are gaining a little bit more confidence to come back. But I don't know, that could change if rates keep on getting pushed out. I mean, the Federal Reserve had a conversation, not a conversation, they had a rate announcement yesterday that decided to hold rates. It seems like the Federal Reserve is still expecting to do 325 basis points cuts this year and 325 basis points cuts next year, it was supposed to be for next year. But that being said, I mean, with that sort of news in hand, shouldn't that give buyers a little bit of confidence that Canada is probably going to do the same, or if not, even more cuts than that?
I think it comes down to this. My conversations with people, you've got two extremes. You've got people that have a shit ton of capital. They'll be like, yeah, I've got like $600,000-$700,000 saved up, and like, I'm ready to deploy it into like the next decent project that comes up. They're being very picky about the projects that they can invest into. And then you've got people that are like, I really want to buy something, but I don't have any like liquid capital anywhere available, right? Or it's like, I deployed into this, this, and this. Like even us, we've deployed into a bunch of random shit, and now it just needs to come back, right? But you're kind of just stuck waiting until it comes back.
Right.
So I feel like even if they do rate cuts, like, will the investor community, it'll take a while for the investor community, I think, to come back like full force, right? Right now, it's really like first time home buyers going with their
right
down under a million kind of purchases. Those are moving, right? But anything above that seems to be a little bit of a
for sure
uphill battle.
And that's the inventory for flippers, right? Like they are selling to the first time home buyers and the people who are not looking for fixer uppers. So that business model makes sense. But again, like I think I'm overly cautious because of the flip that I got burned with last year.
Yeah.
Due to my own stupidity and just being caught offside with the market conditions. So yeah, I'm being a little bit more cautious. I would rather double down on the wholesaling side of things, right? Because the inventory is moving quicker, although the assignment fees are still not what they used to be, but inventory is moving quicker. Like people are not offering stupid amounts on wholesale deals as if like 2022, early 2022, things were selling at ridiculous amounts, right? That were not justifiable, though not justifiable. The prices that are selling now are still justifiable. It makes sense. People are making sure that they run their numbers. And I think that's sort of the story that we hear on the market as well. Things are going above asking price, but it's not ridiculously above comparables.
It's true, except I've noticed an uptick in prices that things are selling for since December to now. Like obviously not on like a week by week basis, not going up that drastically. But I think if you bought in December, you've probably won. You've probably made a good lift just from then to now, right? And a good lift doesn't need to be like 10-20%, like even like 5% on leverage asset is freaking awesome, right? But yeah, it's been a pretty quiet week, I think, for the both of us. Like, aside from a couple of like inflationary news and stuff like that, a couple of deals kind of gliding into our plates a little bit here and there, right? I don't think there's been anything in the world of drastic movements or drastic pieces of news, right?
Oh, we are looking at selling a property, possibly. So we're getting a contract. Yeah, we should. I mean, basically,
you're gonna sell it through the podcast.
Yeah, I mean, it's gross revenue is about $10,000 a month. We're only looking at $300,000. No, but it is a property, single family home. Not sure we want to hold it in our long-term portfolio, right? So the tenants are going to turn around. It's the one that you were talking about. I don't know if you mentioned it publicly, about the clay pipe.
I don't know if we talked about it in the podcast.
I could maybe mention that really briefly, and then we'll jump into the podcast.
Basically, I think single family home, yes, but it's a student rental. In a pretty prime student rental area. It's a couple blocks from the university. We bought it a while ago. It rents out. Like, it's not really a problem that way or anything like that. It's just like, you know, at a time in our lives, student rentals, I think, were the way we wanted to go. And I think every investor goes through this, right? Student rentals seem to make the most sense. And then you go, hey, you know, it's a little bit of a headache. It's probably not worth it for our portfolios now. So we're looking at exiting that, but it is with a JV partner. So we'll kind of see how that exit pans out and if he ends up like buying us out, or maybe we end up just putting it on the market and seeing how it kind of plays out, right? But what led to all this was we had a clay pipe that broke, essentially, right? And for anyone that doesn't know, this is like the piping that leads from the house to the main sewage line. And so when that breaks and you've got students using the water, you can imagine where the water goes. It basically backs up into the house. So now we have, I don't think the tenants know this. And you know what? Both of our names are listed with the property, so we can talk about it pretty openly. But I don't think the tenants know it's sewage backup, right? Like, it's got to be sewage backup, right? Like, I don't think they know.
I think they do. Maybe. Okay. Anyways, the tenants are going to move out, and they should, right? Because it's not a fix that we can do in 1 or 2 days, right?
Yeah.
And it's the end of the semester. We're leading into April, so perfect time. It's going to be turnaround. We're going to fix that. We already got in quotes. We already got a commitment done. We got a quote for the renovations to be done and getting another quote from someone else. So obviously, we're going to get multiple quotes to figure out which is going to be the best price. And then we can sort of decide from there. But ideally, it's an asset that we want to get rid of. We made this pretty clear. We've been getting rid of some smaller stuff, specifically single family homes to make way for bigger projects.
We have this one and then one more, right? That's the other one. 430.
What the hell are you talking?
434, no?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So that one we're not getting rid of yet, right?
Yeah, but that, we could. We could. Other one that I lied, and I'm like, hey, you know, at any point, if everyone else is down, like, I'm down to kind of move that.
Oh, there's another single family I actually have listed with one of my JV partners. Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, we sue, but I'm not going to give the address. Yeah, but we have it listed. It's been on the market for close to 6 months, but we got an accepted offer, fortunately. Oh, yeah? Yeah, and the reason being is because it is in a more prime location where prices are a little bit more elevated. So usually the activity in Sault Ste. Marie right now, from what we've been told with the realtors, happening in the 200K price point, right? This is double that price point plus some. And so we've gotten some interest. We finally got an offer. Hopefully that all goes through. But it's, again, single family home, prime location, not a great rental, but at the price we got it at, It was a good rental, right? But we can't refi or do anything to it. Otherwise, we're going to be negative cash flow. So getting rid of that one as well. Anyways, enough rambling from us, enough updates. Let's jump into today's podcast. We have Ming Lin from Volition Properties. You guys probably already know who he is. If you haven't, make sure to check out our earlier episode where we had Ming on. We talk about how to make numbers work in Toronto. So Ming is one of the co-founders of Volition Properties, which is ahead of the curve in Toronto real estate. They focus really on development plays, taking single families, transforming them into multifamilies, and that entire strategy, including the 4+1. So we get into Ming's thoughts on the 4+1 strategy, what his clients are currently doing in today's environment, what opportunities there are in Toronto. And we even open up the crystal ball a little bit and sort of figure out his thoughts on what he thinks is going to happen in the future of Toronto real estate. This is an episode you don't want to miss out on. A lot of fantastic golden nuggets. And without further ado, actually, leave a 5-star review and also share with a friend, comment, do whatever you can to support this podcast. And now, without further ado, we'll jump into today's episode.
Just a heads up before we get started, this podcast is all about providing you information, not financial or legal advice. So if you need the real deal for your situation, hit up a professional. We can't promise you our information is always up to date or accurate, and we're not responsible for any investment decisions you make based on it. Markets change, information change, you know the drill. Anyways, thank you for hanging out with us responsibly. Let's jump right on in.
Hello, everyone. We are joined with our very special guest. And I think it's for the second time, actually. We had a fantastic first episode, and we're going to have an even better second episode. We have Ming Lin from Volition Properties. Ming, how's everything going, man?
Pretty good, man. It's been a busy spring market. Early start of the spring market, I should say.
Yeah, yeah. Not what we're expecting.
Not at all.
So for anyone that doesn't know, we had Ming on the podcast recently, but Ming, why don't you give everyone kind of a quick update on yourself, who you are as an investor, as a realtor, the areas that you cover and so on.
Sure. As an investor, I've been doing this for a long time. I bought my first investment property in Waterloo, semi-detached, 3-bedroom student rental in 2001. So I don't even know if you guys were born yet. It was a long time ago. I did a lot of student rentals. I'd call Chase the Shiny Object for many years. So between me and my business partners, we had invested in, Hamilton, Sudbury, Mississauga, Edmonton. You name it, whatever was cool at the time, we put money in that city. Eventually, our investing story took us a bit different journey, I think, from a lot of people, in that you sat down one day, me and my business partner, Matt, and at the time, this is like I Sam. And we were looking at our investments, and Toronto seemed to be doing financially just as well as our other properties when we fully analyzed it, not just cash flow. But the tenant profiles were a heck of a lot easier for us to deal with, right? Because we had properties at the same time. And so we kind of made this conscious decision to liquidate our properties outside of Toronto and focus on Toronto itself. At the same time, we spun up a business to support other investors going through it. I'm a realtor, and I've got a team of folks now who focus on Toronto real estate investing. The crazy few who want to make this city work. That's, I guess, me in a nutshell.
Awesome. And in the previous episode, we talked about the different strategies that
you can use to make Toronto investing work. So I want to make sure that everyone checks that out. We will probably cover this on a high level in this episode, but not going to go as deep as the previous episode we did. From the beginning of this podcast, you mentioned it's a busy spring market, right? Like, let's just jump into the nuts and bolts. Like, what's going on in boots on the ground in the GTA markets right now? We're hearing that multiples are coming back. Is that true? What do you think is the cause of that? And is this something that you would have anticipated, like maybe even back in November 2023, that would be in this market today?
So, no, didn't anticipate it. Let's start there. So as we were looking at kind of mid of end of next year, what I think was very evident was this rate instability, right? And while rates, I think, don't fundamentally change the economics of real estate investing, right? I believe it's fundamentally a supply and demand market, right? Rates influence immediate demand, right? It was uncertain. And because it was uncertain, people didn't act. A lot of people were on the sidelines. And that kind of went through November, December, January. And when we had the rate announcement end of January, and that wasn't a spectacular announcement, but all they had communicated was, hey, we're going to hold, and that's probably it for now, right? And it was a very very wishy-washy. It wasn't like, you know, we're going to start cutting rates or anything like that. It wasn't, but that's all the market in downtown needed to hear. And literally the next week we were seeing 10 offers, 15 offers, 20 offers on properties. The market completely did a 180. This is specific to the downtown market, right? This is not the GTA as a whole. Right. And this is typically what we see. Like, the first mover when it comes to market recovery is the downtown core. So Little Italy's, Little Portugal's, Corso Italia's, if you're familiar with the downtown Toronto neighborhoods, East York, places like that. This is where we're seeing this kind of competition. And specifically single family or multifamily-ish. We can get into a bit more of that later. But specifically single family homes that end users are looking for. Those are extremely hot. They're still extremely hot. And this has been going on since kind of last week of January till now, mid-March right now. But what hasn't quite happened yet is the spread of that throughout the rest of the GTA. So you're seeing the market picking up in your new markets, and Ajaxes and places like that's getting busier, but it's not nearly what we're seeing in downtown Toronto. And this is one of the reasons why we focus on this, on the city as well, is we know it's the most resilient when we look at our data. So that's why we try to invest there if we can.
That's interesting. Like, and when you talk about the downtown core, you're talking about detached properties, or are you saying like townhouses, condos? I mean, I know condos are standalone, but
yeah, let's get into that. So detached, semi-detached. Townhouses are a bit softer, and condos are a completely different market.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely still a buyer's market on the condo side. So
why do you think that is? We're going to leave condos aside, right? But why do we think that townhouses aren't kind of increasing in line with detached? Because in downtown Toronto, the detached properties, it's not like we have a massive backyard and like, you know, that stuff, right? Like, you're still very much like your neighbor's like a foot away, right? Is it essentially the 4+1 strategy that's causing the detached to go up drastically? And then is that being applied to semis as well versus like townhouses just not viable? Or
I don't think obviously if you're an investor, you're familiar with what's happening with the 4+1, you know, the 4 has to write and build one at the back to get to 5 units. Oftentimes, you know, using CMHC financing, which is why everybody's trying to get 5 units. It has brought attention to properties where that kind of development can happen. I think it's a little overblown in the investor circles because, you know, we're in a bit of a bubble, right? So everybody around us seems to be doing this. But the reality is the vast majority of transactions are still just regular old real estate. So, you know, why is the condo market lagging? And I'd say to a much lesser extent, the townhouse market. Because if you're looking at a row house that's like in one of these prime areas, it doesn't matter. It's also very, very popular right now. But if you're like looking at like a townhouse in like North York, which is kind of like a townhouse condo, that's more what I'm talking about. Like, they're essentially condos, right? So those have not quite picked up. So condos, I think there's a couple of things. One is just straight supply, Right. Right. There's a lot of available inventory right now. And when there's a lot of available inventory, prices have to come down to match. And they have been coming down there. They continue to trend down. But I don't think they've hit bottom yet, like single family. Single family always historically has been much more resilient too. So like when we saw downturns in 2020 or 2017 or 2008, every time the market takes a hit, single family is the first to recover.
Right.
Good. And so typically condos lag. We see that lag anywhere from like 3 to 6 months to 1 to 1.5 years before it starts to pick up. Yeah, just I think supply is a big one. And I'd say the sensitivity of the condo market is higher than that of other markets. So you got to think of your buyer, right? You're out there buying, let's say, a $1.5 million typical Toronto property. Nuts to say that that is your typical Toronto property. But like, you know, if the price is up 50K, down 50K, it doesn't make as much of a difference to a buyer. So they're a little less price sensitive. But the condo guys, when it comes to interest rates being high, you know, every 200, 300 bucks we're talking about is massively impactful to their lives, right? Because they're buying a $700,000, $800,000 condo. So they're more sensitive to rates. They need the rates to drop more than anybody else for that market to pick up.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. I guess one point that you mentioned earlier that I want to echo is that, and I think this gets missed with a lot of investors, is that interest rates are demand influencers, right? And a lot of the time it's short-term influence, right? Like when an interest rate goes up, people pull back. When it drops, people jump back. It's really impacting the demand curve in the short term, not in the long term, right? In the long term, there's like, as we know, we see this pent-up demand. And as soon as we get a lick of good news, people just jump back in the market. And even for me, like I always hang on to these things like, oh, like the rate renewal, that's going to drop the mat, et cetera, but people have done saying these different like doom and gloom situations that just never seem to pan out because there's always buyers that sit on the sideline. I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are throughout the rest of this year. So obviously we've started this year strong. There's arguments that supply is going to pick up in the spring. And there might not be buyers to absorb it. Like there's so much, like, I guess people just have their own sort of thought process. What is your thought process on how the market's going to shake out this year? And why do you think so?
So I think the biggest thing is the rate cuts, right? So I think a lot of folks, and you know, I think I'm in the minority here, but a lot of folks are expecting 1-2% rate cuts over the next year or so. And I mean, I would love it to happen. All my mortgages are variable, so it's really awesome right now for me as an investor. But I don't think it's going to happen as quickly. And we have to look at the over, like the impact every time we see a rate cut. To your point, Austin, when you know once there was stability, the influence of rates disappeared pretty fast, and people came flooding back in. That's not even a rate cut. This is just rate hold. And we're seeing the market explode in downtown. I'm not saying Toronto is the be all and end all of Canadian real estate, but they have to be very careful. If they cut rates too quickly, you're going to see a housing crisis that we have already in the city explode, right? Imagine we, you know, those monthly payments start dropping. More people are going to get back into the market, especially if there's supply out there. So I have my Econ 101 teacher, like in my head, you know, telling me that rates, you know, inflation, these things increase quickly. Prices go up fast, but they're always sticky to come down, right? It always takes a long time for decreases. And I don't see this being any different. I would love for rates to come down quickly. I just don't think it's going to happen as quickly as a lot of folks are hoping or thinking it's going to happen. Because it would be quite a mistake if they go too quickly and then have to bump the rates up, right? Yeah. Like that would send shockwaves to the market. So it's better for them to cautiously come down than it is for them to go too quickly and then have to correct, right?
A couple points there. Like today morning, I was reading something on Twitter. It was like, to buy a $1.5 million home, you need a $400K income or you're like broke. I can't remember. Like one of the big guys on Twitter was posting this. And it's partially true, right? But I think a lot of times if you're buying a $1.5 million home, yeah, some people are fully leveraged like 80%, right? But a lot of people are putting larger down payments and stuff like that. They're kind of which is another to kind of support your earlier point as well, right? Like the single family homes just being a little bit more resilient, right? Like interest rate hikes not having as big of an impact, right? Like I'd imagine 2-3 million might have an impact, right? But a lot of times if you're upsizing and you're putting 300-400K as a down payment, the leverage model is a little bit lower, right? So I think that's important. And then the second thing I'll say is whenever there's a BOC sentiment, and sentiment I think is driving the market right now, not just on like buyer sentiment, but also like what can people qualify for? Because no one's going variable anymore, right? Everyone's going for that fixed rate, right? And the fixed rates are constantly moving based on sentiment, right? Which is, you're seeing like you do a pre-qual for someone in February and then like a couple weeks later, you're like, oh, that's like completely irrelevant because now rates are quite a bit lower or quite a bit higher or so on, right? So I think, you know, going into the spring market, sentiment is probably going to be what drives it. I think we're at like 5% or something like that on like fixed, right? Which is a pretty solid rate compared to December of last year. But I'm curious to see kind of what goes on with the rest of the year. So from an end home owner perspective, it sounds like you're saying demand is coming back in the detached and the townhouse market in core markets, right?
Yep.
We might start to see a ripple effect into Scarborough, Etobicoke, maybe Markham and Durham and Mississauga, right? Which would make sense. What are we seeing from the investor side?
Good question. So I'd say the investor side, the pure investor properties. So let's say it's like a turnkey triplex or fourplex or five unit property in that niche. Those have not come back in terms of demand because right now the numbers are very tight. You need a cap rate, you know, kind of in the mid to high fives for you to be cash flow neutral at what people are being qualified for. And Toronto is traditionally more of a 4 cap, 4.5 cap market. So not to say there aren't buyers, because we have an off-market 5.6 cap triplex right now. And I've got 15 people coming to see it on Friday, right? So that...
Where is this?
It's in East York.
East York,
And it's turnkey, you know, it's not like super amazing property, but it like nothing needs to be done. It needs a good clean and maybe about 15K worth of work, painting, route changing, caulking, the easy stuff, right?
Yeah.
But it's operating at a 5.6 cap and 5.6 cap. And our Toronto investors know you don't see 5.6 and they're even willing to have like maybe even slightly negative cash flow because all they need is one rate cut, like 0.25% rate cut or and they're neutral again. It has to be a very compelling property right now for it to have interest from other investors. But if it is, I tell you that if you want to get to opportunities in the market, this is one of the opportunities. Triplexes, fourplexes, any sort of investment property where you've got underperforming rents.
Listen,
people are like, they're not even touching them. And you can get them at market discounts right now in a competitive market because you have to deal with, you know, if you want to turn the tenants over, you've got to have a planner there. You got an iron stomach and an iron wallet to go through that process, right?
Right.
But that is turning people away. So actually some of our developers who are, you know, more interested in doing like full teardown redevelopment are looking at those kind of places, you know, like a duplex bungalow that's rented out below market. They can't otherwise get in. It's a little, well, I should say they can't get in. They're getting in at prices that are not competitive, right? Just a nicely staged or empty or vacant bungalow.
Is that because you're essentially like dealing with the tenant risk by whatever that form is for, like you're going to demolish the unit and therefore, okay.
Absolutely.
Gotcha. Okay.
Sorry. I was just going to say like one of the fundamentals that I think gets a little overlooked is the shift in risk and why that is relevant in pricing. Like last year, for example, kind of to the mid end of last year, we were in a buyer's market and people didn't want to buy, even though we're in a buyer's market. Why? Because risk had shifted, right? From the seller to the buyer. You're entering a market where you're not sure what's going to happen with rates. You're not sure what's going to happen with your property value. So of course it's a buyer's market, right? Like you have to understand, like the risk is shifted over to the buyer. That's why it's in your favor. There's no risk for a seller in a seller's market like right now. You know, there's no risk for them. Therefore, it's a seller's market. Now you're a buyer. You're trying to fight over what some of these properties. It's because there's a shift in risk. Right? You can't have it both ways. You've got to have like, if you're taking on the risk, therefore you're getting a good price, right?
Right.
So yeah.
It seems like most of your clients are looking
I guess the developers have the most sort of edge in this space because they can get discounted assets that most traditional investors wouldn't touch at the moment, right? Because you need very deep pockets and not a lot of people want to deal with tenant turnaround.
Yeah, I mean, our developers are getting good deals if they're willing to deal with the tenant stuff. And not all developers, right? Because it can be a nightmarish process, right? Mm-hmm. To try to redevelop property where somebody's currently rent, right? Even if you are in the right to redevelop the property you own, you guys are very familiar with the LTV, right? It can take months, year, 2 years sometimes for it. And that can kind of be advantageous for some of our developer clients who have to go through the planning and design process anyway, right? They're going to take 6 months. So, you know, they might as well rent during that time and then maybe work on the LTV process in parallel. So it's not too bad for them. But if you're a regular investor and you're trying to come into one of these, well, I wouldn't recommend coming into one of these places. It wouldn't work because you don't have a good reason, really. You know, we don't really believe in like a shady rent eviction or cash for keys is very risky. In the headlines of tenants demanding huge amounts of money for cash for keys.
Yeah. You're gonna see me in the newspaper forever try that again. So we're on the conversation of opportunities. Like I think one of the biggest opportunities that a lot of investors are shifting towards, and Ma, you mentioned this earlier, is a fourplex with the laneway suite in the back, right? And we mentioned it, taking it to CMHC. What are your thoughts on the missing middle? I'm sure you have some clients doing it. I'm sure that you probably ran some numbers on it or had discussions with people entering those projects. What are your thoughts on the feasibility of that? Do you think it's going to catch storm and it's going to be the new norm? Because a lot of these sort of investors that we chat with, they have a strong belief that that's basically the, like, in 10 years from now, you go anywhere in Toronto, you're just going to see fiveplexes everywhere, right? So curious to hear your thoughts.
So, I don't know. I feel like I'm the downer on your episodes.
No, we love hearing different thoughts, right? Like,
yes, we're Toronto is actually very progressive when it comes to pushing this missing middle building stuff, right? Like they're doing all the right things. And like now they're throwing density requirements out the window in the right zones. They're allowing for larger buildings. Like last summer, I think they increased all zone heights by 1 meter, right? To allow for flat roofs for multifamily. So you can build big multifamily now. And if you're actually just trying to build a McMansion, our McMansion will be smaller than their multifamily rents because there's a whole bunch of exemptions there. So all the right stuff is happening, but I don't think Toronto's going to be full of multifamily, just like the turnover of properties needs to happen, right? And that's not going to happen at like in 10 years, you're not going to see a massive turnover of all the properties in the city, right? A lot of people own their properties for much longer than 10. That's kind of one. Two, it's a large amount of capital to do these things, right? Like, you know, we have a bunch of clients who are going through this, and it takes, you know, a good, like, acquisition aside, you're looking at like $1 million to do one of these things, right? And not a lot of people have that sitting around. I think if this becomes, it catches the interest of large institutional investors, like right now we're having conversations to family offices, right? If that happens and you start seeing, you know, tens of millions pouring into these kinds of projects, then maybe you'll see a little bit more. But the reality is it's hard to find lots that work, right? It's not like we look every day. So like we have a back office team. All they do is scour off market, like all our off market partners. Everything that goes off of MLS, they look at all the criteria and every day their output is zero. Like maybe once a week or twice a week, we see something that works. Most of the time, there's nothing out there which actually works for conversion. Stuff's moving in the right direction. The city's doing the right thing, but it's going to take quite a bit of time, I think, for these to actually make an impact on the way.
Why are you saying like nothing's worked, like nothing really works? Like what do people need to look out for when?
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people are just like banking the opportunity, right? You're buying the property that you think in the future you can make into a 4+1, right? So like, in your opinion, what do they need to look out for?
Yeah. So I think like a lot of people underestimate the lot size they need. So, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, you know, I can do this on 17 feet, 16 feet width lot. And technically you can, but what's going to happen is your layouts are going to suck for the fourplex, right? Really, you need kind of 20 to 25 feet of width, especially if you need a side setback to access the garden suite at the back, right? So you actually need quite a bit of width to get a comfortable two-bedroom layout. Remember, people are looking at your product as a condo alternative. It has to be alternatively better, right?
Right.
So, and you do that mostly giving people more space because you don't have the same sort of convenience that a condo renter does. You're not right on a main street where you're super close to you know, walking to amenities and transportation. So people who are looking to rent at these places generally are looking for a little bit more room, right? They're working from home. So, you know, your layouts have to have that kind of den space or like a work from home space. You need a two bedroom layout. So you need more width and you also need more depth than I think a lot of, you know, people considering these lots are looking at them. Like realistically, you need at least 110. 120 is much better. If you're dealing with a garden suite, you've got a crap ton of angular planes as well. So you need a relatively large lot to do this. And, you know, all the numbers, there's not tons of laneway and garden suite data. You need a three bedroom layout, right? In order to maximize your rental return on that lane. So I think one, like just lots are that have this larger configuration in the downtown core. They're not that common. And then two, they need to be free of trees. They need to have decent grading, right? Like you don't want to have place on a steep hill. You know, you need to be within the distance from the fire hydrants for laneway and garden suite. So like it keeps getting reduced and reduced and reduced. And there aren't that many truly viable options when we start cutting through all these things. Like, you know, let's say you wanted to do a severance, right? And do two of these side by side. Well, that, you know, we're still restricted to our zone to do that. And then if the garden suites you're putting at the back, now you've got to have side setbacks on both sides of your semi. So now you need a 37 foot wide as opposed to like you could sever 30. For what we're trying to do, you actually need 37 feet, right? So yeah, I can go on and on. but it is like
most great. So if lot is the biggest issue, does it make more sense to be looking at North York, which has like 50 right. lot? Like someone sent me like 100 by 100 recently that was bidding more yesterday, but does North York make more sense? Scarborough, Etobicoke, does it make more sense to look there now, whether or not you build on it right away, right?
Yep.
Versus the downtown core, because I also have people that are doing downtown core, right? So I'm just trying to gauge like, which one has more potential in your opinion right now.
Yeah, good question. So like if I was looking, it depends on what your exit strategy is, right? So if you are going to buy and hold on this, then I wouldn't go for North York. And that's just simply the cost of acquisition to the rents that are needed, that they're going to get out there. Doesn't work, right? The rents aren't quite high enough. And if you're planning on doing CMHC financing, they run different, like their DCR is relatively the same. But when they go and run their comps out in North York, they're not going to have market rents high enough, right?
Right.
So then your numbers might not work, which means you're not qualified for CMHC financing.
Right.
So like, that I think is the challenge. Like you guys are both brokers, super familiar with this, but like, you know, these MLI select programs, CMHC, they really need to see high rents. Like that above all is what is going to work for your refi strategy. And a lot of the surrounding Etobicoke's, Scarborough's, North York's, just they don't have the high enough rents right now for that to work. And maybe in the future.
Right.
But right now, that's a bit of a challenge to get the financing to work out properly.
That being said, I mean, in our previous episode, we chatted a lot more about the like the triplex and fourplex conversion strategy, right? We briefly touched on the laneway, but a lot has changed since we had our first episode. Right. Are the triplex conversions still viable? Or is it just like, if you're going to do that strategy, you need to make sure your lot has the potential for more? Right. Because before, like, it was just like, oh, turn it through units. You can just take the existing building and work with it. Like, are you guys still leaning towards that? Why or why not?
So Yes and no. So let me tie this in. So I was talking about different exit strategies. One is buy and hold, but I guess it's not really an exit, but you're holding the property once you've done work. So in that case, you know, you're refinancing with CMHC, you really need to make sure that you've got, you know, excellent rents, right? But you could condominiumize, right? And we have a bunch of clients doing that as well. So they have a condominiumization strategy, which hasn't quite picked up here in Toronto, but I think that's actually what we're going to see quite a bit of if I'm talking about like future stuff, right? As people turning these properties into resaleable condos.
What do you need to do to do that? Like for it to be condominium?
Yeah, this is a terrible word. Condominiumization is the process. To go through a condominiumization strategy, you're really talking like surveyor and lawyer to help split up the units. And it's not without precedence. There's actually a bunch of places that have gone through condominiumization, you know, like church conversions and stuff. A little less common that you're seeing it happen on multifamily, but it will happen, right? Like it's commonplace outside of GTA. You see it like in Montreal, for example, certainly in the US. And, you know, my client that's kind of leading the charge within our Volition circle, he used to do these in the States. So he's like, came here and he's like, why can't I just repeat the same model? So he's going through this process right now. The build's the same. Right. Like you're building a multifamily, you're under the same building code. So if you're familiar with how to build, a multifamily rental property, you now have the same skill set of building the condo. You just need the right lawyer and a surveyor, which as to how that property is split up. Right. So I think you're going to see a lot more of that. And that actually gets you into North York, Scarborough's, because now you're not looking for rental comps. You don't need CMHC to come save your butt. Right, to make it work. Now you're looking at it's more like ARV analysis,
right.
Condo analysis. The risk there is that it's pretty groundbreaking. Like there's not a lot of people going through condominiumization, and it's hard to say what the properties are actually going to sell. Right?
Yeah.
You can run a bunch of comps and say like a condo, you know, 300 meters away is selling for this much, but is your condo converted house going to? So, you know, you got to be a little conservative when you're writing those numbers, but it does work for, we have two clients doing this right now. So
I think I know one of the clients that I was chatting with, he works as a consultant with Volition as well. He, the lawyer from the state, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I know that. Yeah. We had a chat and he was going through and I found it very interesting. Sort of the pushbacks and questions I had for him was like, in areas like the beaches and stuff, which is sort of where he's targeting East York, right? There might not be a ton of condos there. So would someone really, to your point, would someone really want to buy a condo there if that's the only one, right? Because everything surrounded around is single families and all of that. And I think he said the break-even price per square feet was going to be around 900 based on his analysis. So I mean, it's an option for someone who wants to get in that neighborhood, who's like dead set in getting in that neighborhood and there's not much other inventory out there. But I just found it like that's the risk element. Is it gonna sell? Right?
And that's the thing. Like when you're a market leader, you're taking that market leader risk, right? So this is interesting. So our both clients who are doing the condominiumization have pivoted to the west side and they're doing it close to St. Clair instead. Part of the reason
it's a bougie area.
Yeah, and it's you know, the comps are easier to establish with all those condos there on St. Clair. So it could, it's a little less risky, but you're still groundbreaking, right? It's not like there's lots of properties that are converted. Yeah.
And I imagine the lot acquisition in St. Clair is ridiculously higher than like some of these other areas.
It's cheaper than beaches. Beaches is baller. But yeah, if you're on St. Clair, let's say you're like kind of like St. Clair west, more towards Corso Italia.
Yeah,
The acquisition's not too bad.
Okay, yeah.
So anyway, like, I think that'll be really interesting to follow over the next year or so. Hopefully, it's done in about a year and a half, and to see how that goes. I didn't answer your original question around triplex.
Can you remember what the original question was? That's it.
Yeah. Let's get to that. Is it still worthwhile to do like the single family, the triplex, single family, fourplex, if there's really no potential of a laneway? Because before, like we go back 3-4 years ago, that was the strategy. You didn't have to look too far beyond that. But now you know that, okay, like we should look for lots that have the potential to do more development on it. Like, is it still worth buying these single families that you could only really turn into a triplex or fourplex and that's it?
So I would say, like, worth it depends really on what you're capable of, right, as an investor. I think the biggest challenge is, like, I have a lot of clients who get into, like, this analysis paralysis, right? And they're trying to get maximum yield, and they work themselves into a fiveplex, like, 5 units, right, through that process. Because, yes, it is the best yield. But, man, it's, like, $1.5 million on acquisition, $1 million development. Like, it's a $2.5 million project. Easy. So, like, a lot of people don't have that kind of money. So, are you better off doing a lower yield investment and be invested? Absolutely. And I think that's where even duplexes for some folks, and I would say, like, you're living in it for it to make sense, really. But, like, a triplex still makes sense for people because they're in it at, like, 1-4, and that's it, right? Like, there's no additional development that needs to happen then. And, you know, right now, you're cash flow neutral at best. Likely, you're a little bit cash flow negative. But the reality is the appreciation for single family properties in the city has outpaced that of condominiums and other cities. I mean, condos, it's outpaced at about 2% on average per year. And like 2% doesn't sound like much, but that's a leveraged 2%, you know, on a $1.4 million asset. So it's hundreds of thousands of dollars you're talking about over time. So like, yeah, it does. When the math's there, it still makes sense to get into triplexes. Cause I say, like, there's a lot of talk about these larger multifamilies, but the reality is it's out of reach for the vast majority of people, unless you're teaming up and doing JV.
Yeah. Like I think the triplex strategies, depending on how you're doing it and how much you're demoing and how much you're rebuilding and stuff like that, like still like a 400, 300 to 400 kind of play, which if someone has the 300 and if you have means to borrow the remaining shortfall from like friends and family, it's a much easier, there's less of a barrier to entry. Now, what I want to ask you about, Ming, is Toronto, everyone knows 4+1, cool, like that's the strategy that's working here, right? But with regards to the surrounding market, where do you see it becoming viable next, right? And you know, I know you're an expert in Toronto, and that's kind of definitely the market that you kind of focus on, but you've done Kitchener-Waterloo. Yeah, probably know Mississauga, Markham, Durham, right? Like, where can you kind of see as the next market where it'd be equally as viable?
So, I'm going to cheat, but I'll say that. So, I actually don't believe very strongly in the rest of the GTA, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, like I walk the talk. I've sold off pretty much everything that I have outside of the GTA because, you know, I still have this Waterloo fourplex and I keep wanting to sell it, but man, it's a crappy return. Like, yes, it's my best cash flowing property. This is a fourplex. It's mostly student rentals, but I've owned that place for, I don't know, 15 years now, over 15 years, and it's doubled in value in 15 years. That's terrible. Right. Like it sounds good, but like my Toronto property's doubled in value in 6 to 7 years versus a 15 year doubling period. So it's like half the return. And, you know, if you're into large multifamily, you're into cap rate, it doesn't matter. But if you're into the smaller 3 to 5, like you're still comp base, you're still following what's happened. And like the value of my property just hasn't gone up a ton out there. And I'm just waiting. Yeah. Market to recover out there so I can offload it and money into building a laneway suite on one of my places in Toronto. So I would say that the next up and coming markets, the why I said I'm going to cheat a bit is it's for me, it's actually neighborhoods within the city, right? Because Toronto is a massive market. And, you know, what's happening in even within East York is not all of it. So, you know, we did this analysis about 6 months ago, 10 months ago on what we feel that the next up and coming, right? And how do we crystal ball this? Generally, it's through transit development. There's a pretty strong correlation between mass transit development and property values. Are you guys familiar with the East Harbor project in East York?
No.
So this, the city and private developers bought, I think it was a P&G factory or something like that. It's right at the foot of the DVP, right where the DVP meets the GART. And it's like this old factory. They keep putting a different banner on it every year. It's finally getting torn down now. But that is basically going to be the new Union Station. So they're trying to make a new transit hub because it's kind of crazy that all transit terminates at Union. So they want to have another station, and we're going to have two existing GO train lines already run through that area. So they're just going to have them like terminate in that building and then continue on. So it's both the Lakeshore East line and the Stobo line that go through that area. And the new Ontario line will be going through there. So you have subway plus GO train now terminating in East Harbor. And the whole area is quite large. Like it's I don't know how many acres or hectares, but it's very big. And the whole thing's going to be redeveloped. And if you're familiar with that pocket of East York, it's a bit of a transit denso. So that is one of our up and coming neighborhoods, because right now, you know, I'd say property prices are lower because there's no transit there. Rents are also lower. But in like 5-10 years, that area will be quite different once they're finished their construction. With 5 years too short. 10-15 years, right? Like, we're going to move at the speed of government.
Distillery and Leslieville area, like that entire kind of.
Yeah, kind of the lower end, like right down to, right down where it meets Lakeshore Road. That area. And it's quite industrial looking. There's a lot of like,
yeah,
movie studio lots and stuff like that. But that area will gentrify quite a bit, and property values will go up quite a bit once we start seeing the transit being accessible here. So like that's what I'd say. And just because, like, you know, when I've gone back and looked at the Mississaugas, New Markets, I don't know Barrie, kind of like within the 1 hour drivable of Toronto, the numbers don't work out well for investors, right? Like, the property prices are high and the rents are low. So you might as well be in the city where the property prices are high, but at least the rents are
low. Right. How about your thoughts on specific transit? Like, this is obviously a big project. This is going to be the next Union Station, yeah, as you were saying, but how about like smaller stations, like with the Eglinton LRT line? Some people are betting that property prices, whenever that finishes around there, are going to appreciate. I mean, they probably already have appreciated now that it's at near completion, but what are your thoughts on smaller projects like that, where you're just nearby a subway station?
So absolutely, it'll have impact. Like, I think the LRT is you've seen some impact, but the LRT is one of my favorite case studies in that I'd say 90% of the time you build it, they will come, right? Like, you build mass transit and prices will increase. But the LRT, I think, is a perfect example, especially the west end of the LRT, where it hasn't had as much influence on property prices as I think, you know, a lot of people expect.
Yeah.
The general rule is, like, you know, you don't buy near a development until ground is broken, right? Because before then, it's all paper pushing and things can change very quickly with policy or whatever, funding can just disappear. So you wait for ground to be, but ground has been broken for ages along the kind of the Eglinton West portion of the LR. And yeah, you know, property prices have increased there, but I wouldn't say that they're outpacing the city, which you'd kind of expect it to outpace the rest of the city given what's happening. So I think transit is an excellent indicator, but that's a perfect case study of when it hasn't quite happened. Maybe it'll happen once it's up and running. Maybe
people
like, you know, because freaking delayed forever, right? So maybe once it's up and running. But as of now, it's not quite up.
Like, Yonge and Eglinton is still like way, way more improved than it was like 10 years ago, right? Like, pretty popping there, the restaurants and all that kind of stuff. Different vibe from downtown, right?
This is more like, right, like another, west of Allen Road. That side of the LRT hasn't.
Yeah. So why do you think it hasn't though? Is it the desirability of the area in general? You feel like there's not enough businesses or whatever to gentrify the area, or like new development around there?
I mean, like, some condo developers have taken a chance. There's one big one right at Eglinton and Oakwood, for example.
Yeah.
And like, I do think it's going to happen. The problem is, it's like, timing on this, right? You know, that's the hardest part when you're trying to buy on a gentrification. Because right. like gentrification curves are like, they start low and it's an S curve. Like it just shoots up and then it levels out. And you don't know when it's going to shoot up. It could be 6 months. It could be 6 years. And it just hasn't shot up yet. I think it will, but like you could be getting in now and still waiting 6 years for that to happen. Right. Like, because it's like you need this kind of snowball effect. To your point, you need the gentrification to happen, and you need your first hipster coffee shops to come in.
Yeah.
You know, when that stuff starts happening, more and more things start to change and gentrify. That's when you start hitting that S curve. But like, not enough of that has happened yet for that snowball to happen and for prices off.
Right. Like, it's interesting. I'm just looking at House Sigma right now. There's still $1 million like detached properties selling at like Keele and Eglinton, like blocks away from Eglinton. And it's like,
yeah,
like,
nuts, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly what you said though, right? Like it's literally like a block away from like,
yeah,
I think where Austin lives, and you know, like not too far from a lot of like good areas, right? But yeah, that's interesting. So your overall consensus though, like I guess I'll ask you this. What's your expectation on rent, right? Because last year we saw a crazy run up on rent, right?
Yeah.
What I've heard right now is that things have kind of like tapered off since like maybe October or so, right? It's not necessarily going up. It's in some like suburban markets, like further away, tertiary markets, they've come down a little bit, right? But I'd love to hear what you're seeing in Toronto.
Yeah, I actually think rents are stabilized. I don't think you're going to see much more increase this year. I wish I had data which could support this. Anecdotally, what I'm seeing is a lot of people trying to sell their condos are unsuccessful at selling their condos, aren't willing to take the price cut to current market and a rent. So you have a lot of double listed places right now, right? As both rental and sale. And those, you know, they're probably willing to take another $100 off or $200 off their target rental than they are take $50,000 off their sale price.
Right. So, right.
You know, they'll rent it out, wait for the market to recover, and then they'll try to sell it. And it'll be very difficult because it'll be rented under market. So, condo.
Yeah.
And then a lot of people won't want to buy the condo because they're worried the tenant won't move out if they're, you know, using it for personal use. So, but I do see, you know, the rental market is not, I wouldn't call it soft, but it's not at that breakneck pace it was last year.
Right. Right. And what do you attribute that to? Because like, I guess last year, we let in 1.2 million newcomers. It seems like they're still letting in a lot of people. What is slowing down the growth? Is it just an affordability? Because I guess it's not sustainable to increase rents double digits year over year, right? We're not saying that rents are going to drop. We're saying that it's probably like the growth curve is going to be like probably with inflation now, right? Maybe like 2-3% year over year.
Yes.
So, why do you think it just like halted totally?
I think it just caught up to demand, right? Like, remember, we were in this like weird low demand period after the pandemic. So one of the things we were talking about is like within our investor group was, okay, we're in a, you know, pandemic happened, you know, all these people are moving away from the city, right? And we said, okay, well, whatever you do, don't get into long-term rental. Like now's the time for month-to-month Airbnb. I did it myself. A bunch of our investors got into short-term rentals. Midterm, I guess, is the more correct term. And a midterm rentals during that period. Because we knew the rental market was going to recover eventually. We just didn't know when, and we didn't want to be locked into. So I think what's happened is just the market has recovered back up to where it is. But if you're talking like crystal ball stuff, what I think is going to be really interesting is actually housing prices in about 2 to 3 years. So you mentioned this big influx of immigrants into the country. So typically when an immigrant moves somewhere, they rent first. So you'll see a hit of rental. You'll see, you know, it come up with the rise in population. Those people need someplace. So rental market is always the first one. But after a couple of years, most of these people are trying to pivot to become homeowners, right? And it usually takes about a 2 to 4 year time period for them to be in their new city, in their new country, for them to get to that point where they're ready to start looking. And I think in 2 to 4 years, it'll be really interesting to see what happens with that, you know, 1+ million people. And then now ongoing 300,000 to 400,000 people, what are they going to do when they start to look for a place? And I wouldn't be surprised to see a spike in housing prices in a couple of years.
That's a good point. I think part of it as well, like even with rents right now, is people just hit like affordability limits, right? Like you're hearing more, like, you know, for years people have been living at home longer with their parents and stuff like that. I now have like clients that are just like, you know what, we're getting married, but we're just going to live with our parents until like we can figure something out in the future, right? So I think multi-generational living will also be, it's already been on the increase, and it's likely to continue with that. So this is all really interesting and a good kind of context for a lot of people that are looking at Toronto. And you know, we've been pushing Toronto, I think, for the past better part of a year now, just kind of like talking about it, because we see like big opportunities in Toronto now compared to some of the tertiary markets, right? But Ming, with regards to your business, like we usually just like to ask two questions at the end of the podcast. So with regards to your business, Volition, helping people out, et cetera, how do you see your business kind of shaping out in the next 2 to 3 years?
So our business continually gets more difficult. Like I had a conversation with my business partner. This has got to be three or four years ago. And we like cracked the nut on maybe even longer, 7 years ago. And, you know, and then they were starting to get difficult for whatever market conditions. Like, man, like we keep having to reinvent what works. And I was like, well, that's kind of our job, right? So like one of the things I think that we pride ourselves on is like just taking, not only taking the research and talking about what happens, but like synthesizing that into solutions, be that, you know, the kind of helping our clients through the 4+1 process right now, or condominiumization, like some of the more advanced stuff, helping clients come together oftentimes, because like, hey, you know, somebody might be bringing mortgage qualification, but has no money and just sort of matchmaking. Like our business has become a lot more problem solving for our clients over the years. And I think that's going to continue to wrap up. We're gonna have to get deeper in.
Very true.
We'll continue to focus on the city. I don't think it would take something major, I think, for us to pivot away from Toronto. But yeah, like that's where I see the trend for our business.
No, it's very interesting. I mean, ultimately, it's entrepreneurship, right? You're constantly like pivoting, like seeing the next opportunity and kind of trying to take advantage of that. So that's really good. The second question I'm going to ask, it's a little bit different from normal, but think of someone that has like 200 to 300K in available capital, right? How would you tell them to play the Toronto market?
So I guess 200K to
300K. Two to three, because 200 might be a little bit.
It makes you very close to doing a triplex, right? Like,
this is not the traditional second question. Go for it.
Mai is getting a personal consultation right now. Well, let's put it this way. Like, if you have 300K, you're awfully close to be able to do it. But you need the 20% down. There's closing costs, all your taxes. So, like, I'd say you're probably, like, 50K away from being able to do something turnkey. And you'd be in, like, kind of the East End of East York, or maybe up kind of, like, Corso Italia's, a little Portugal's maybe. But it can still be done. And the reason you need a little bit more is because at that price point, kind of, like, low ones, you still need to do a little bit of work, right? You're these kitchens, bathrooms, flooring. So you're probably still spending repairs. But that can be done. And that's what I'd be doing. And anything to get into land ownership in the city, especially if you're in, you know, an R-zoned area with a semi-decent lot. And in the future, doing a 4+1. I'd say if you're less than that, I would be house hacking. Like if it was me and I had 200K in my pocket, I would be doing like a live-in duplex or triplex, because that purchase price is like 900 to 1.1 to just fair. Out of where I would say I would be comfortable buying a triplex. But I'd then be looking at it like a nice duplex with the, where you can get good rents for the second suite, not just like a small basement.
Mm-hmm, perfect. Awesome. Let's still ask the last question. Mai, go for it.
The last question is just really for a newer investor getting started in today's market. What kind of advice do you have to kind of share with them?
What's the biggest risk?
The
biggest risk?
Yeah.
Getting into today's market?
Yeah.
I think the, like, I wouldn't say it's as limited to today's market, but in general, I see people falling into two categories. And that's like the overzealous or the non-action taker. I think if you fall into either one of those extremes, at risk, right? Like you can over leverage. And there's some people who are so heavily leveraged. The moment there's like, I think this last year shook a lot of over leveraged investors, right? Slight changes in interest rate and they're in trouble. And like, I'm not super highly leveraged, but even like for me, it was like, you know, like I said, all my mortgages are variable. I saw like tens of thousands of dollars increase in my mortgage since 2 years ago. I had to sell some properties to deleverage a bit, but like it was within the realm of ability. Like if I had my whole portfolio that I had to deleverage, holy crap, like, or like 70% of it or something like that, that, and if things weren't selling, that could have ruined, right? So I think like being a little more conservative, pays off. Like it just takes time, right? Like being super leveraged, you're just trying to compress the timelines 4 or 5 more years. And that's fine. Like you get to the safe place and without all the heart. And then the other side is people who just spend all their time educating themselves. Don't dive in it, even in a non-optimal way, right? Like it doesn't have to be the absolute best return. You're still better off getting some return. So even if it's a condo and you're renting out a room and then you take that condo and it's part of a plan to flip it over to get into a duplex and then you're renting the basement to get into a triplex, like, right. You have to have this path. So.
Yeah, like climbing the property ladder. I think that's an important point. Like with real estate, it's important to take your time. It's a snowball effect. Like once you build a ton of equity on one property, it becomes so much easier to take that rollover, maybe buy 2 properties. And once you gain equity on those 2 properties, like it just goes from there, right? And it could be really, for a lot of investors, you ask investors that have been in the game for 15 years, like when did you buy your first property? Like 10 years ago, right? Like now I have like 9 or 10 investment properties fully under my name. But a lot of that acquisition happened the last 4 years because it took a while for that first property to depreciate, get to that point, then re-leverage it into spinning it off into growing a portfolio. So definitely it's not a race, right? Like, especially when you're investing in Toronto, you got to be nice and slow with it. You can't be taking too much risk.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, go buy the good real estate, like save up and spend the money on getting great locations, great fundamentals.
Right.
Because that pays off over time instead of trying to get a deal. Right.
Right. Anyways, yeah. So that concludes today's episode. Ming, really appreciate you jumping on. As always, great conversation here. A lot of interesting thoughts. I like, we always like hearing different people's opinion on the city, what works, what doesn't work. So just another sort of viewpoint there. If people want to follow you, connect with you, learn more about you, how can they best do so?
We're on Instagram-ish. Austin knows we're trying to step up that game a bit.
It's hard.
it's painful. I'm a middle-aged man and my social media is indicative of that. but we are on Instagram of Volition Properties and our website. You can hit us up, volitionprop.com.
So all of that will be down in the show notes below. If you guys enjoyed this episode, leave us a comment, share with a friend, give us a 5-star rating. It helps bring great guests like Ming on the podcast. And until next time, everyone, invest smarter and live better. Take care, all.